Welcome to Ed History 101. I am your host and lead researcher, Jennifer.
And I'm Paul.
Hi, Paul.
Comic relief. Something.
I don't know. Yes, man. So when we brainstormed this episode, we called this episode, in my notes anyways, I called it the Freedom episode.
Freedom.
Yes, because this episode is all about why is it kids are allowed to leave public education at the age of 17, 18, whatever. Why do you think you're allowed to escape the bounds of high school?
Because I completed the required content in the time allotted, and they shook my hand and gave me a piece of paper and told me to get out.
So you were 17, right?
Yes.
Did you remember any kids who graduated early?
No. Doogie-Howsers in my class. No.
That doesn't help me, because this is supposed to be all about you. So I'm kind of hoping to center everything on you.
That's easy, then.
So you were 17. I was 17, too, I assume.
Most everyone who was 17.
Yeah, most. I think that's pretty much a typical thing. So where did 17 come from? We're going to try and figure that out.
Well, that's good.
And I'm going to tell you that a very significant meeting was held in 1892 that determined 17 would be the norm. I'm going to tell you all about that. Are you excited to hear about that?
Yes.
Because you're an incredibly good sport about these things. So I'm going to give you first the good news.
Okay.
Well, the good news is statistics. And that is, right now, at this moment in time, there are 26,400, no and, because I know math teachers listen. I have to make sure I say my numbers correctly. 26,400 high schools that serve 15 million students.
That's a lot of students in high school.
Yes. In the 1890s, there were about 3,000 serving about 500,000 kids.
It's considerably less.
Yes, to kind of give you sort of a frame of reference. You want to hear the bad news, though?
Yes.
Is that you, considering you are the center of our show, everything centers around you, we have been a disappointment forever.
What have I done?
Well, not you, like, personally, but white males of European descent who graduated from public schools have been disappointing colleges forever. You keep showing up at colleges unprepared.
Wow.
You keep showing up for jobs unprepared.
That's how we are.
And it's how you've been forever, for a long period of time. So colleges and employers have been complaining forever. Colleges really elevated the complaints in 1892 to such a degree that the National Education Association, NEA, had a meeting. And they called it, well, they could have called it many things. You know, the old deluder Satan law. Mm-hmm. They could have gone the lyrical, poetic route. But instead, they called it the Committee of Ten.
The Committee of Ten.
Yes. They could have called it the, you know, these rascally know-nothing slacker youngins, which would have been a great name for a law. But they went with Committee of Ten.
The Committee of Ten.
But the Committee of Ten, you'll hear this mentioned many times. We're going to keep going back to it again and again in our podcasts. But I don't think Committee of Ten accurately communicates who this committee was and what they were seeking to do.
Well, because it was a diverse group of educators from all walks of life getting together to figure out,
discuss a variety of issues.
Right.
No, really, it was a committee of 10 white dudes who got together to complain about all of the things.
But they didn't all live in the same house. So
this is true. Diverse.
It was diverse.
Yeah. So and the good news is with this committee of 10 dudes, who I'm actually going to call like the white dude committee, they were representing women. There were no women who had anything to do with this.
Because they couldn't represent themselves.
Apparently not.
That's reasonable.
But fortunately, the president of Vassar College was there. And he has an he had an all-female student body, because I think he's pretty much passed away by now.
I would suspect, unless he's a vampire.
Yeah. That could explain a lot about the decisions of the Committee of Ten. But the president of Vassar College showed up, and he represented, they didn't quite have this title yet, but I think this is fantastic. There's a whole network of women's colleges around that period of time, and they were called the Seven Sisters.
The Seven Sisters.
Yes, to go along with the Ivy League, which I think is just so, ridiculous and awesome. We do love our catchy titles for things.
You gotta sell your brand.
Exactly. Okay, so this guy was representing Vassar College and the women, the girly colleges, apparently. There was a gentleman there, a dude there, representing girls in school. And he was the principal of the Boston Latin Academy, which is not to be confused with the Boston Latin School, which is, in fact, the oldest high school in America.
Wow.
Founded in 1635. Now, you will note that 1635 is significantly before the year in which Virginia passed a law that said kidnapped indigenous children had to be forced to read the scripture. So that was our first kind of compulsory law. Wealthy, well-to-do, you know, elite sons of Puritans didn't need to be forced to go to school. They voluntarily went to BLS, Boston Latin School. I'm going to call it BLS because I figure that's what the kids call it.
It's better than saying Boston Latin School over and over
again. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And Latin is one of those words that loses its meaning the more you say it, so I will stop saying it. So BLS. They started going to school at BLS in 1635, and it acted as kind of a feeder for the colleges. Harvard, for example, was founded in 1636. The interesting thing about Boston Latin School, BLS, is that it was originally called the South Grammar School. And it was almost a brick-for-brick recreation of a school called the Boston Latin School in Lincolnshire, England. Excuse me, Boston Grammar School. What they tried to do was bring over a British school. And one of the things I found really compelling about BLS is that their philosophy, or their kind of guiding principle, was to say, quote, "Our scholars dissent with responsibility, and we have persistently encouraged such dissent." So that was BLS in 1635.
Really, 'cause when I dissented in high school, they weren't having any of that.
That's because by the time you got around, you were already feeling the consequences of what happened in 1892. Which was all about standardization. The Gang of Ten White Dudes. But in 230 years, we went from encouraging dissent to standardization because colleges were disappointed. So it's really kind of interesting to think about what are kind of the drivers for our school. And the Committee of Ten, or Ten White Dudes, decided unequivocally and clearly, they said, and it wasn't policy per se, but it pretty much became de facto policy. And they said, what will happen is this. 8 years of primary education, 4 years of secondary education, which means if you started school at six, which is what most compulsory laws asked for, you'd graduate and you were 17. And I tried to figure out, why did they decide that combination of eight and four? Where did that come from? So I looked to a couple of our kind of American, like, famous people around that particular time and tried to figure out, well, maybe it was because 17 is when a lot of people did things. And as far as I could tell, 17 doesn't really seem to be a magical number. So, for example, some of the founding fathers, Hamilton, Burr, and Lafayette, they were in their early 20s. Hamilton went to college, but he started college at 18, which is kind of typical for that period, but it wasn't always the case. I mean, there were lots of instances of college students at Harvard and whatnot of men being in their 40s. So I'm not quite sure where this whole 17 thing came from. Why it was 17 is this magic sort of idea. And it seems to be because. So, for example, I thought,
that's kind of how we do a lot of things.
It seems to be. Like they just said, 8 years of primary and 4 years of secondary. So I thought maybe it was because in the 1890s, it was because people were getting married really young. And so they wanted to make 17 so they could get married like at 18. But in 1890, the average age for men getting married was 26, women at 23.
So there.
Yeah, so there doesn't really seem to be a here is why 17 is the age that we picked, but we did. And they decided, here's what it's going to be. We're going to graduate, you're going to go to 8 years of primary, and then you're going to go to 4 years of secondary. So, Committee of Ten, the Ten White Dudes, pretty much established that. And some of the things that are really fascinating about the idea of the high school and giving these kids a place to be for those 4 years of 9th through 12th grade is we are so used to thinking, or I was so used to thinking about a lot of things happening on the East Coast. The first schools were there, the first colleges were there, everything, you know, that's where people were first, you know, on the East Coast. But when it comes to high school, there was actually more activity out west and in the middle. So, for example, between the 1890s and the 1930s, there were more high schools built out west than there were on the East Coast. And one of the reasons is because those states that had farming and ranching and mining were wealthier states, and their population was more homogeneous. So they were able to build more high schools for students to go to. And the whole idea of graduating from high school that 17-year-old really caught on between the 1910s and the 1940s. That's considered the golden age of the rise of the American high school, 1910 to 1940. And in 1924, right in the middle of it, the graduation rate in California was twice that of the graduation rate in New York State.
Wow.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised by that.
Yeah.
Like, and I was thinking, what you'd think, where there were more people, there'd be more kids, therefore there'd be more high schools. And so the statistics would just hold up. There'd be more graduates on the East Coast. But, yeah. California. Yeah.
Go California.
Go California. So concurrent to the rise of the high school for white, male, occasionally female, European descendants, was a rise in what were known as Indian boarding schools. And you may have heard of Carlisle, which was a school in Pennsylvania. And Native American parents were either forced to enroll their children in these schools. They were told, you know, give us your children, they're going to this school. Or there are some parents who decided to enroll their children. And one parent's summary that I was reading said the parent made the decision that their child would be better off if they were enrolled in the school, because they would better know how to negotiate the world of the European if they learned how to walk and talk and, you know, speak like a European. So from 1879 to 1918, this particular school, a high school as it were, and for Native American students in Carlisle, served over 10,000 Native American students from 10 different tribes. So 10,000 children walked through these doors. They graduated a grand total of 158.
That does not seem like it worked well.
No, it didn't. And the philosophy of the school was, and I quote, kill the Indian in him and save the man.
Well, that explains why it didn't work.
Yeah, it's not a very child-friendly environment.
No.
It does give us some rather terrifying insight into these two, I mean, three or four kind of concurrent timelines of education. So while this man was saying, kill the Indian in him and save the man, in which they were asking children to change their names in some cases, the Committee of Ten was meeting. So these are both said in 1892. And the Committee of Ten said, and I'm going to read some words, and it's going to sound like word salad, and I'm sorry for that, but I think it's important to hear the degree of equivocation that was happening amongst the Committee of Ten white dudes. And they said, quote, secondary schools of the United States do not exist for the purpose of preparing boys and girls for college. Secondary schools' main function is to prepare for the duties of life that small proportion of children in the country, a proportion so small in number but very important to the welfare of the nation, who show themselves able to profit by an education prolonged to the 18th year and whose parents are able to support them while they remain so long in school.
Blah, 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 blah.
I know, right? I have no idea what that said. And I think basically what they were saying is an incredible amount of rationalization as to why they needed to standardize high school. So we have these two concurrent things happening. At the exact same time, all of this is happening, 1890s, we are into Reconstruction. It is after the Civil War. We have now thousands of freed slaves looking for an education. And black communities throughout the South were doing everything it took. They would build their own schools. They had to pay taxes, which went to white schools that their children couldn't attend. So these communities were paying the taxes to support the education of white children and also paying to build their own schools. And while this was going on, they ended up creating a tertiary system. Tertiary. Yes, in the immortal words, I don't know, some reading teacher I saw said, never mock someone who mispronounces a word because it means they learned it by reading. Tertiary is one of those words I didn't hear out loud until about 20 minutes ago. So they had primary, secondary, and then tertiary schools. And many of the tertiary schools, or the schools that were created by the black communities, are now known as HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. And they were founded on, we will create what our community needs to live the lives they envision for themselves. For Fisk University, for example, whose first students in 1866 ranged in age from 7 to 70. So that was their very first class of students, 7 to 70-year-old students. And they shared, quote, a common experience of slavery and poverty and an extraordinary thirst for learning. Another college, which is now Spelman College, they graduated their first class in 1887 with high school diplomas. Yeah. So the community did whatever they needed to do. And there were some desegregation efforts happening up north. But really, that has been the history of the Black community, pretty much in education, is working incredibly hard to create the conditions that were being denied them by the white majority. So there's this incredible history to be learned about the HBCUs. And the idea of these three different themes is so compelling because the committee of these 10 white dudes to read these texts is bureaucracy. The sentences are paragraphs long, and it was all about creating the bureaucracy of the high school. But the cool thing about high school, it is a uniquely American invention. America invented the high school.
All right.
Yeah.
Mark up.
That and the... That and the automobile, you know? Yay! Yeah.
Hey, airplanes landed on the moon. Come on.
All that cool stuff. And I may have read a few too many propaganda-y texts about high school, but it's a one of the quotes that I said, or one of the books that I read said, it's not only the high school movement from 1910 to 1940, was not only a uniquely American phenomenon. The secondary school as we know it today was a uniquely American invention. As an institution, it was rooted in egalitarianism and was often a byproduct of the extensive state university system. So in other words, there was a feedback loop. Colleges would get students coming in who couldn't handle college, so they'd leave taking their money with them because colleges wanted them to stay longer and they couldn't necessarily expand the size to get, you know, more freshmen, as it were, at the time. They went down. Upstream?
Upstream.
Downstream? Upstream. Upstream. They went upstream to yell at the high schools and say, you got to do better. So from that came the Committee of Ten. And in terms of thinking of high school as an American invention, we can look across the pond, back to England. In 1936, 38% of 14-year-olds were enrolled in school in England. In the States, it was 68%.
Wow.
Yeah. And there's all sorts of really fascinating feedback loops between colleges and local school systems and employers. So employers would say, local employers would say to a school system, the kids you're sending us from town don't have the skills we need them to have to work in our industry or in our factory or whatever. You got to up rigor. What word should we use there? Up the...
Up your game.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Up your game. So this whole kind of cycle started going to a point now where it was expected when you were 17, you would be prepared to go on to what's next, whether it be college or career or something else.
But unfortunately, at 17, you don't know what's next.
You don't know what's next. So, I have no idea.
You're ready for what's next. Go figure it out.
Yeah. And when we talk about curriculum, we're going to talk about the idea of college preparatory curriculum versus vocational, you know, curriculum and things of that nature. And that's another thing the Committee of Ten white dudes figured they would fix.
I think the Gang of Ten's a better name.
Gang of Ten?
Yeah.
Can I work in the white dude thing or just go with Gang of Ten?
Gang of Ten white dudes?
Gang of Ten white dudes. So for sure, we'll call it the gang. So in modern today, in 2016, only four states and D.C. have stuck with the original guideline of 13 years, meaning you have to stay in school until you're 17. And it's New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Virginia. Most of the New England states, including New York and Massachusetts, now you can leave when you're 16. You only have to stay for 10 years. Other states like Alaska and Pennsylvania, North Dakota, and North Carolina, but not South Dakota or South Carolina, require students to stay in school for 9 years. So technically, you can leave from those states when you're 9. All 50 states also have a law that allows for early release from high school if you are a gifted child. They also allow, if you are a child with special needs, you can stay in school until you're 21, if you have a special program, which I thought was kind of interesting. But really, it's that 16, 17. And there are, in order to get a diploma, it's not like you reach 17 and surprise, win, yay, congratulations. There's other factors. And we'll talk about those other factors in other episodes. But 17 seems to be the magic year for releasing children.
That we picked from a hat.
We decided this is what it needs to be. And then you were...
I had reasons.
Yeah. But those reasons appear to be because that's what we've always done. So you have to be 18 to vote. You're drafted at 18. And you're released... You could be released from high school at 17. Or 16 or 15. Hmm. It is utterly fascinating. And I'm sure you see that so much of it is state dependent. There isn't a federal policy around that or anything. In 1920, 16% of 17-year-olds were graduated from high school. By 30 years later, it had jumped to 57%. The high for all students around was 1970, which is about 76%. Today it's 80%, but for Black students it's only 69%, and for Hispanic students it's 73%. So it's highly dependent upon race, on state, on socioeconomic status. Are you ready for your pop quiz?
I'm.
Here's how the pop quiz works. I'm going to read Paul a quote, and he has to guess if it's from the, let's go with, I want you to pick a decade in the 1900s.
Okay.
So which decade in the 1900s do you think this is from?
20th century. Got it.
Okay. A graduate, according to Webster, is one who has compiled a course of training in some particular line and who has therefore acquired proficiency in it, a proficient or adept. This is not an accurate description of the ordinary graduate of the American high school today. There are so many children who have been given their high school diploma for serving time, accumulating credits, and getting a passing mark that the high school graduation has lost its significance. The passing mark varies wildly among teachers. A unit for one child in one school and under a certain teacher may be equivalent to two or three units for another child and for the same child in another school or under the instruction of another teacher. Pick a decade.
I'm going to go with the 1940s.
Close. Very close. 1930.
Damn.
Yes. So you see, we've been complaining for a very long period of time.
We're a nation of complainers. We started out complaining. I don't want to pay these taxes. And we're still complaining.
So the colleges are only doing the American thing? The
American way.
Nice. Very, very nice. All right. So until next time, class dismissed.